Well, in our culture, one of the main objections, major objections that people have towards Christianity is that they say it's too exclusive. And there's something really ironic about that, that probably a lot of us, if you're a Christian, you've heard that somewhere, that, hey, nothing against Jesus, but it's too exclusive to say that Jesus is the one way, or that it's the only kind of religion or way of faith that people should follow. That seems too close-minded, and really there's got to be more to that. The irony is that what Jesus got so in trouble for, one of the things that got Jesus into so much trouble, especially with religious people, is that he was far too inclusive. And we've come to the point in our culture where many people think he's far too exclusive. And I think part of that is because the way of thinking about religion or faith and the way that we pursue God and the conversation around that has changed. But I also wonder if part of the reason why so many people in culture, and maybe that's been you, have thought that Christianity is too exclusive is because those of us who are Christians have missed something vitally important about how we live out our faith that caused Jesus' original hearers and original audience to believe that he was far too inclusive rather than exclusive. There's a couple of main metaphors that people use when they talk about the inclusivity or exclusivity of different ways of thinking about God and religion. And so you'll hear this sometimes as people will say, you know, religions are kind of like we're all going up a mountain, but we're taking different paths. And so the reason why different faiths and religions look different is because we're all going up the same mountain, but we're taking different routes to get there. And they are kind of all the same, or at least they're leading to the same place. We're all trying to go up the mountain to find God. We're just taking different routes to get there. Another one is people will tell kind of a story, and they'll say, you know, trying to pursue God is a little bit like we're all blind people, and there's an elephant, and we're all kind of touching the elephant, but we're touching different parts of it. So we all have different ways of describing what God is like, but we don't realize that we're really all looking at the same thing. And so, you know, some people say, well, what does that thing look like that you can't see, but you're feeling? And some of us will say, well, it's long and it's skinny and it's flexible. And we say, oh, that's because that person's touching the trunk. And other people will say, it's big and firm and strong. And we'll say, oh, that's because that person is touching part of the leg or part of the belly. And it's a different way of feeling and experiencing really the same thing. And so in our culture, that's become very common, is that we talk about, you know, really, we have this inclusive, we're all talking about the same thing, but in different ways. We're going up different paths to try and get to God, or we're trying to figure out a God that we can't really see, and we're all touching and experiencing different parts. And so we don't need to be too exclusive, and we can be more inclusive, and we're all talking and thinking about the same thing. And I totally understand that. And to a point, I get it, because, you know, God is beyond what we can totally fathom. And so there's truth to the fact that we're all trying to figure out a being that we can't fully understand. And we're all walking different paths, and we're all having different experiences, and it looks different. So to a point, I completely understand that. But when it comes to the claims of Jesus, there's something here that's important. That what Jesus claimed, and what Christians, I believe, should claim, is that, number one, God is no longer on a mountain. He's come down towards us. And that God has not left himself invisible, but has showed himself to the world through Jesus Christ. And here's a point where I think we need to understand and realize that the very claims of Jesus are incredibly revolutionary when it comes to that. It's that Jesus says, we're no longer people who are supposed to try and get up the mountain towards God. God has come to us. And we're no longer people trying to figure out what could God look like and would God look like. And if God showed up, how would we know? The claim of Christianity is that God has showed up in the person of Jesus, and we've seen what God would do and say and teach and model and encourage us to do if he showed up, because the claim of Jesus is that he has in Jesus himself. But I still think for many of us as Christians, oftentimes in the church, there's something missing, because Jesus was still misconstrued, even understanding those two points, as incredibly inclusive, where we have found him in our culture to be extremely exclusive. And I think there's something for us to learn, for those of us who are Christians and for those of us who consider ourselves part of the church, in why is it that oftentimes we are not seen as a people who are radically inclusive when the one that we claim to follow was considered that. And today I want to look at a story and try and mine some of what it looked like for Jesus to step into this world, what Christians believe it looked like for God to step into culture and into real people's lives, people who have real problems and real struggles, and to show them that the kingdom of God is available to them in a radically subversive and revolutionary way, in a way, as we've been talking about through this entire series, that most people thought was completely and totally unexpected. So we've been working through the Gospel of Mark, and we're going to be in Mark chapter 7. So if you want to follow along in your Bible or on your Bible app, I welcome you to do that. If you don't have either of those things, that's fine. The words will be on the screen behind me. And we're going to read about this story, about this interaction that Jesus has with someone that most of his contemporaries, most of his original audience and people who were most like him didn't expect him to have, and one that I think tells us so much about how those of us who claim to be followers of Jesus ought to treat people who are radically different than us, who think differently, who look differently, who act differently. This is Mark chapter 7, and I'm going to start reading in verse 24 if you're following along. It says, "Then Jesus left Galilee and went north to the region of Tyre and Sidon. He didn't want anyone to know which house he was staying in, but he couldn't keep it a secret. Right away, a woman who heard about him came and fell at his feet. Her little girl was possessed by an evil spirit, and she begged him to cast out the demon from her daughter. Since she was a Gentile born in Syrian Phoenicia," and we're going to stop there for a second, and we'll find out what happens after that, but we want to set up the stage, because what is set up for us in those words, just setting up the interaction that's going to come from this, is the setup for an explosive story. One that when we read it, you might read that and go, this doesn't seem super out of the ordinary, but a lot of the details here, if you're kind of on the inside, if you're a first century Jewish person understanding the context, you realize that something really explosive is being set up in terms of this conversation and what's happening. First is the setting. We just know that Jesus has traveled from one spot to another. He goes across this lake, he leaves Galilee, and he goes to the region of Tyre and Sidon. In some of your translations, Sidon is in there. Some of them, it's not. It's because in the oldest manuscripts that we have of this, some of them say Sidon and some of them don't. Probably just because these are two places that are really close together. Some thought it was really important and some didn't. But what we do know either way is that Jesus goes from a place, Galilee, that's inhabited primarily by Jewish people, which means they think Jewish and they act Jewish and they have religious background that Jewish people have. And he goes to a place that's inhabited by mostly people who are not Jewish in Tyre and Sidon. They call them Gentiles, and Gentiles is a way of saying everybody else who's not Jewish, which means these people have different ways of thinking, different ways of acting, different way of looking. And so that's put out there here for us to understand that. And all of a sudden, we have a woman show up. It says Jesus, he's not advertising where he's at. Jesus needs some rest. Jesus needs to get away from some people, just like everybody does at some point. He is not looking to have a huge crowd around him at this point, because that's becoming something he's getting used to. And so he's trying to draw away, but he can't fully keep his setting secret. And so we find that this woman comes to him. Her daughter has been possessed by an evil spirit. And so she's begging him to cast out this demon from her daughter. And it says she was a Gentile and she was born in Syrian Phoenicia. Here's what those things tell us about this woman. The woman is, obviously, a woman, which means she's the wrong gender. I know, it's obvious, but it's important. She's the wrong gender in this cultural setting. It means that it is inappropriate for Jesus to be speaking to her in public, because she's not his relative or a daughter of his or his wife or any of that. They're probably not supposed to be speaking at all. And many people would have thought that that is kind of scandalous. Just that's how their culture operated. It also is important to notice that a lot of people in that culture would have believed that women didn't really have the capacity to reason like a man. Listen, we're a couple of thousand years ago, okay? But this is part of the cultural expectations, thinking that women, and part of this is true, they didn't have opportunities for education like men did. And some people thought that's just not the place of a woman. And there was no expectation that you would get into a conversation where you would reason through something between a man and a woman. She was the wrong gender for a conversation with Jesus. Secondly, she was a Gentile, which means she was the wrong race. And this runs deep, that the Jewish people, just like pretty much all the other people of the ancient world and a lot of people still today, believed that they were God's people and that God's people took care, God took care of his people. And a lot of times that was couched in an ethnicity, that we are an ethnic group and that therefore we have a God, and other people have their gods that they go to, but God is first and foremost interested in our people, people who are like us. And so for the Jewish people, we believe that God is here first and foremost for the Jews and maybe some other people, but when they come and they convert to being like us, but first and foremost, God is here for us. And so this becomes part of the discussion we'll talk about in a minute, but she was the wrong race. And then it says she was from Syrian Phoenicia, which means she was also the wrong religion. She was most likely coming from a pagan perspective. And in the Old Testament, the Jewish scriptures, there's a lot said about people who come from different religious backgrounds, people who are pagans. In fact, the fact that she is from Syrian Phoenicia means that she was a descendant of the Canaanites. And the Old Testament has a lot to say about how the Jewish people were supposed to interact with the Canaanite people. In fact, the Old Testament way of dealing with the Canaanites was either to ignore them or to destroy them. Those are the two things that you read in the Old Testament, which means that Jewish people who are reading this, Jewish people who were steeped in their scriptures, would have gone back to stories like you would find in the book of Joshua, that when your people, the Israelites, were supposed to go to the land that God promised them, when you found Canaanites, what you were supposed to do with them was slaughter them. When you read the laws of the Old Testament and it said, how do we deal with Canaanites, people who are living around us, who are pagans that worship other gods, you were supposed to ignore them or destroy them. Ignore them because if they get too close, they could infect you. They could drag you away from the right way to live. They could influence you with worshiping their gods and living the way that they live and stealing away your morality. It was dangerous to get too close to these kind of people. And so maybe you would say at the best of times, you're supposed to ignore them. Make sure you don't get too close to them and they don't get too close to you. Make sure that your people don't marry their people, because once you build those kind of strong relationships, they're going to influence you and drag you away. So ignore them and keep them at a distance. They're just going to make you more like them. Build barriers between yourself and those kind of people. And if you come into contact with them or they're inhabiting your land, then we kind of switch and we go on the offensive and we should destroy them, drive them out, make sure that they are nowhere to be found. That was, for many people in Jesus' culture and religious setting, was the way that they interpreted the Bible. And it's a big deal because it wasn't just about what they were supposed to do. It's what they believed God would have them do. This is how God is telling us to set ourselves apart, to make sure we're not too influenced by people who are not like us. And that's really important, because then Jesus comes as this woman that he's talking to, and we have all these details to alert us to the fact that Jesus is now interacting with someone that these people have a huge background with, and they have a way that they think they're supposed to deal with people who are the wrong gender, the wrong race, the wrong religion. Because our God is interested in our interests, and they have God who's interested in their interests, and our God is stronger than their God, and so as we trust in him, he will fight for us, and he will fight against them. I'm not saying this is what everybody believed in that culture, but that's what a lot of them would have taken. That's how a lot of them would have interpreted the scriptures. And it's one of the reasons we see Jesus get in trouble over and over and over, especially with religious people, because they weren't just basing the way that they were thinking on random opinions. It was the way that they interpreted their sacred scriptures. And when Jesus does stuff like what we're about to read, and he does it in all kinds of different ways, they feel that he is challenging. And he is, I think, the way that they've interpreted their scriptures and the way they think about God and what God is up to and how God would have them live. And it's so interesting that I think we have many of those same challenges today for us as Christians. It shows us something, that we can take the Bible and you can find a verse or a passage to justify all kinds of terrible behavior. And you can find, you know, little bits of scripture if you're looking to justify what you want to do or how you want to live or what makes you find comfortable. You can find justification, if you read the Bible a certain way, for almost anything. And we have throughout history, unfortunately. We've justified things like violence and racism, slavery, sexism, all kinds of horrible things, and said, yeah, but it's in the Bible. And if it's in the Bible, then it has to be all right. We have this set up because Jesus is going to challenge the way that they've read their Bibles, interpreted their Bibles, and thought about what God is doing and how God treats people and how God treats different people. Jesus comes in and shows them something different. Now, when we think about this woman and the details that we have, it goes even a little bit deeper than just saying, well, she was a Canaanite or a descendant of Canaanites and Canaanite religion and all those kind of things. Actually, all those details drive us to something that's even more specific. There is this really famous woman in the Old Testament who is the daughter of the king of Tyre. Remember, Jesus had just gone to Tyre. And it says that she is from Sidon, which, again, is the other place that is mentioned here in the story of Jesus. And further, this woman in the Old Testament was a Phoenician. Again, the other detail that in Mark we read about this woman is that she was a Phoenician. And her name in the Old Testament of the woman was Jezebel. Jezebel was not Jewish, but became the queen of Israel. And as she did, she led Israel into all kinds of evil, idol worship, and destruction. Terrible, horrible things. To the point where Jezebel became the prototypical way of talking about someone who's evil and horrible and who's going to tempt you and drag you away from God in the way that you're supposed to live. And it's not super common anymore, but even in recent generations, you might have heard somebody talking about kind of this woman who's very tempting as a wicked Jezebel. It was like if we could think of one person in history who's terrible and horrible and awful, and if you get too close, who will drag you away from the way that you're supposed to live and make sure that you are participating in evil, it is Jezebel. And she's from Sidon. Her father's the king of Tyre. She's a Gentile. She's from Phoenicia. She's a Phoenician. She's all the wrong things. And Jesus goes to this woman, and all the details line up. So if you're reading this and you know the Old Testament, you're like, Jesus is talking to Jezebel, the most evil person that we could think about. She reminds the original audience of Jezebel, the epitome of an evil woman. And that's the setup for this explosive story. And when you're reading this and you get all that, now you're supposed to go, okay, what's he going to say? How is this going to go? This is Jesus talking to someone that we would consider, those who are insiders in his culture and religion, as an extreme enemy. It's all set up. And then what we'll read in a second is that Jesus crosses gender, racial, and religious boundaries to interact with this woman. Jesus doesn't let any of those barriers preclude him from talking to her, even though all of his contemporaries would have said, this is a non-starter. Don't even go there. Run away as fast as you can. So verse 27 says, Jesus told her. Remember, this woman is coming. She's desperate. She's desperately asking about something that's affecting her family. Her daughter is possessed by a demon, and she needs help. She's come with a certain amount of humility asking Jesus for help for her family. Jesus told her, first I should feed the children, my own family, the Jews. It isn't right to take food from the children and throw it to dogs. There's a really interesting parallel here. This woman has come and said, my family is in crisis. My daughter is possessed by an evil demon, and I need help. And Jesus kind of first, he turns that around, and he goes, I get it. You're concerned about your family. Shouldn't I be concerned about my family? And he goes, my family, I'm considering as my people, not just my biological family, but the Jews. Shouldn't I be coming worrying about my family? Why are you asking me to help you, a woman, a Gentile, a Syrian Phoenician? Don't I have to take care of my family just like you're taking care of your family? And this first interaction of Jesus is what everybody would expect him to say. If you could get far enough that he's even talking to her, which would be a stretch, you would expect him to say, hey, I'm here for my own people. Don't bug me with your problems. You're concerned with your family? Well, I'm concerned with my family, my Jewish family. Shouldn't I be concerned with them? And am I not here to feed the Jewish people, to give them what they need. And to a point, this is exactly what Jesus did, that Jesus' ministry, his message was first to the Jewish people. And we'll see that the reason why he's almost secretive and doesn't really spread that out right off the bat is because he knows he has to get his own people on board, or at least some of his own people on board, before it can go public, before it can go anywhere else in the world. And so he focuses a lot of his time and attention. But this first interaction is what people would expect. Jesus kind of saying, hey, this is not my problem, and I don't need to go there. You see that there's something that some of us there would say, well, this is kind of insulting even. He says, it's not right to take food from the children and throw it to the dogs. And dogs for them was, again, a Jewish way of talking about people who weren't like them, people who weren't Jewish, people who were Gentiles and had different religions, is, hey, we have children here. Is it really right that we feed the animals, the dogs, while we got to feed the children? And you kind of gasp at this and go, Jesus, how could you say something like that? And it's all part of the setup. Verse 28, she replies, that's true, Lord. But even the dogs under the table are allowed to eat the scraps from the children's plates. And this is an incredible statement from this woman. She goes, that's true. I get it. And I get that that's what everybody would expect. And that would be the culturally conditioned right thing to say and to do, is to reject me, is to not do it. And then she calls him Lord. This is interesting. In the entire Gospel of Mark, this is the only time that somebody else refers to Jesus as Lord. Lord becomes the first and most powerful title that the early church, after Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection, gives to Jesus. They say, you're Lord. If you died for us and you resurrected, we're following you. You're in charge. They gave him authority of their lives. Jesus became Lord. But in Mark, there's nowhere that anybody else calls Jesus Lord. There's nobody that puts that together. His disciples don't even call him Lord in the book of Mark. But this Gentile, foreign woman has this humility and this respect. She says, what you said is true, but Lord. And I know that nobody expects you to do anything for people who aren't like you. Everybody's expecting that if there's a Jewish Messiah, he's going to come just for the Jewish people. And I get that you got to feed your family before you would feed about the dogs. But even the dogs under the table are allowed to eat the scraps from the children's plate. She's putting together something that most people had not put together, and something that many of us still struggle with today. She's saying, even if that's all true, and even if I'm a dog and I'm not part of the family, Jesus, is there a glimmer of hope that we could ever have some of the grace and love of your kingdom? Is it possible that what you're teaching and preaching and offering to the Jews could become available to people who aren't Jewish? Is it possible, Jesus, that your message isn't just for one ethnic group, but that maybe it would fall, just crumbs would fall, that maybe we could get some leftovers, that we would take anything that we could get. Jesus, can I get a little bit of your mercy and help? Jesus, I don't believe that you're here for just one people. I believe that this message is going to change the entire world. Isn't where all this is heading, Jesus? Isn't there something more for people like me? And you see a humility and you see a desperation. She's saying, I know that there's something more for me. And it's powerfully revolutionary. Isn't your God here for more than just the Jewish people? I'm sensing that there's more to it. It's a powerful statement that she's saying. And Jesus replies this way, good answer. You know, there's been a setup the entire way. Everything that's expected, Jesus to come back, to ignore her, maybe to destroy her, to send her away, to run away himself. And it's a setup. And he says, don't you understand? I'm not here for you. And she says, but maybe you are. And Jesus goes, good answer. You're figuring it out. Now go home, for the demon has left your daughter. And when she arrived home, she found her little girl lying quietly in bed, and the demon was gone. And Jesus had powerfully honored the faith of this woman that nobody would have expected a Jewish teacher and a Jewish leader to honor or to help or to do anything by, because she had caught a glimpse of the powerfully inclusive and universal nature of a loving God, a kingdom that is offered to anybody who would choose to put their faith in him. And what Jesus is acting out here in this interaction with this woman is based on what he had just taught a bunch of people in the beginning of the chapter 7 of Mark. We didn't have time to read today, but he started into this debate with religious teachers and scribes, people who knew the Bible really well, about what makes somebody pure or impure. What makes somebody acceptable to worship before God or unacceptable to be part of the community or to be part of the worshiping community to God? What were those things? And the Jewish people, because it was in their Bible, had a whole bunch of laws to say this is how you know you're pure or when you become impure and how you can become go from impure back to purity to reinsert yourself into the worshiping community and be able to worship God. And one of those most significant ones, laws, was their dietary laws, what we eat. And they had all these things that they were supposed to eat and a lot of things that they weren't supposed to eat. And the primary reason they have dietary laws was to set them apart from other people. So they didn't eat pork because they thought that pigs were unclean. They were gross. They were disgusting. And so we don't want to eat pork because it reminds us that we don't stoop that low. We're different people. We do better than that. And so when we restrict our diet, it reminds us we're different. We're not like the rest of the world. We're not like everybody else who's impure. And they'll even eat pig and they'll eat different seafoods and things that we don't eat because we're different. It was one of their markers and it was really important. And Jesus got into this debate with people who are so concerned about those things on the outside. And he said, man, you guys are so missing this. He says, do you understand what happens to food? You eat it. It goes into your stomach, you digest it, and then literally, Jesus says, and then it drops into the toilet. That's what food does. He says it bypasses your heart. It doesn't really go into who you are. It goes into your stomach, you digest it, and then that's it. It's just food. It's just a symbol. But you guys are making this who you are. We're different because we're pure. Why? Because we have all these laws that set us apart. And he goes, don't you understand that what's supposed to set you apart is who you are way deep down? And he says, you want to know what makes you impure? It's things like evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, wickedness, deceit, lustful desires, envy, slander, pride, and foolishness. Not the food that you eat. You're so concerned about things on the outside. It's like you're washing a cup on the outside. And you're not dealing with the dirt on the inside. You imagine going to somebody's house, they say, hey, you want a cup of coffee? Sure. They pass you a mug and you go, oh, it's filthy, it's dirty. Oh, sorry. They take the cup, they wash the outside of it, they leave all the junk that's on the inside, pour a cup of coffee and give it to you. You say, you've misunderstood what it means to wash dishes. It's not the outside that matters. That's what Jesus taught. It's not the food that you're eating. Don't you understand? That was just a symbol. What's really important is what people are way deep down and what's happening. And what makes you impure is not the things you put into your body. It's the things that come out because it shows where your heart is at. It shows what's going on deep down within you. And he was teaching that's what's really important. And then in Mark's gospel, it's no action. The next thing that happens is Jesus is interacting with this woman that on the outside, everybody in his culture would have said, she's impure, she's impure, she's impure. Wrong gender, wrong nationality, wrong religion. And then she has this interaction, this deep faith that she expresses. And Jesus meets her where she's at and changes her life and shows up for her. And he's putting on display what he had just taught about, all these impurities. Hey, guys, let's stop focusing on all these things that make us different on the outside. And all these things that we think are so important but are really symbolic, that are really physical or visible that we can all see, but let's start concentrating on where people are at deep within them. And Jesus shows up for those people. And you know, Jesus did this all the time, and he totally threw off how people thought they were supposed to act. One of the things that Jesus often did was he would go and touch people with leprosy. If you were a leper in his culture, you were considered to be unclean. I mean, there's an obvious reason why, because people were afraid that they'd be contaminated. If you touch me, I'm going to get leprosy. But they added a spiritual component to it, and they said, you know, you need to stay out of the worshiping community. There's got to be something wrong with you spiritually. And so if you had leprosy, it wasn't just a physical problem. It was a spiritual problem. People would push you out. Your family would expel you. Your religious community would throw you out. It was a huge deal. And Jesus would go, and over we see he would touch people with leprosy. And you know what people expected to happen when you touch someone with leprosy? That you'd be contaminated and that you would get leprosy. But do you know what happened when Jesus touched people with leprosy? They were healed. That instead of them infecting him with leprosy, he infected them with his grace and his love and his restoration. That he would set people back into community and send them out. Instead of their touching resulting in contamination, his touching brings healing. Jesus turned the way that they thought about contamination and purity and impurity on its head. That you're so worried about people coming in and dragging you away. You're so worried about the Gentiles. You're so worried about the Jezebel coming and contaminating you with impurity. And Jesus came and he said, my mission and what I believe God is doing in this world, what he was doing as God in this world, was bringing a touch of healing to people. He was changing the flow completely and restoring people. And you notice that Jesus doesn't cast out people. Jesus casts out evil. And everybody would have expected Jesus to cast out this woman. Here comes this woman who doesn't fit in, who doesn't fit the mold, who you're not supposed to talk to, you're not supposed to touch, you're not supposed to interact with. And instead of casting her out, instead of saying, you can't come near me, he deals with the real problem. He says, I get it. I'm here for my family, and I understand that you're here for your family, and I'll show up for you. And the real problem here is this spiritual battle that's in her family, and he casts out this demon. And I think that that's a picture of what Jesus was doing in this world. Because I think what Jesus speaks into our world is that people aren't our enemies. But behind all the battles that we fight in this world in different ways, battles of hatred or violence or unforgiveness, all those kind of things, there's a spiritual reality behind it. And that's what Jesus is getting at. That's our real enemy. People aren't the enemy. There's this evil that we have to attack. Which means we have to be willing to break down those barriers that keep us away from people. To walk towards them. To touch them. To empathize with them. To care for them. To love them. To cross the barriers that make us uncomfortable. To cross the barriers that we've built up as hey, this is the religious thing because they're not like me and they don't think like me and I want them to infect me with the way that they think or the way that they live or the way that they act. But to reverse the trend and to follow Jesus to the places that make us feel uncomfortable and to embrace people. Maybe people that nobody would expect us to embrace. So here's my question to you. What barriers do you allow to keep you from genuinely engaging with people who aren't like you? What are the things that you go, oh, that's, you know, we're never going to be friends? Or hey, those people are going to be at a distance. Or I don't know if I could be with someone like that in a real friendship. Or I don't know, until this person changes, if we could ever have a closer relationship. What are those things that you've built up? Differences? Gender? Race? Religion? Marital status? Sexual orientation? Addiction? Lifestyle? Morality? The list can go on and on and on. I'm not saying that there aren't important things on this list. I'm not saying there aren't things that you need to think through, but when we let the differences that we have with other people put up barriers, and when we portray a message that says, hey, once you become more like me, then maybe you'll fit in. Hey, once you clean your life up, then maybe we could have a closer friendship. When we build this exclusivity in a sense that Jesus never intended, we need to hear and see the powerful way that Jesus leads us to engage and listen to and empathize with people who are nothing like us. And to say we won't let anything be built up between us. You know, yesterday there was this royal wedding. Have you heard about it? There was a bunch of people who woke up really early to watch it. I was not one of those people. I will tell you that I couldn't care less. I do not understand the thing. If you're into it, I'm cool with it, but I don't get it. But later in the day yesterday, I did watch the sermon from the wedding. I don't know if some of you saw it. If you haven't seen it, it's on YouTube and stuff. Go back and watch it, because Michael Curry, this pastor, gave a sermon. And as millions of people across the world were watching, he gave a sermon that wasn't just about two people getting married. He talked about a love that transforms the world, and it is worth watching. And in this sermon, he told this story about a song, a spiritual, that slaves in the southern United States would sing, even in the midst of their captivity and struggles and their hopelessness. And it was called, "There is a Balm of Gilead." And the reference is from the Old Testament, the Balm of Gilead. It comes from a couple of places, but Jeremiah, one of the prophets, he was looking out at the terrible state of the Israelite people and you know, injustice and people who were being treated poorly and they were looking for God and they weren't seeing him. He was lamenting that and he cries out, "Is there no balm in Gilead?" You know, a balm is like this healing thing that you spread on your body, this medicinal thing that heals you and makes you better. He said, "Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? Why then is there no healing for the wound of my people? They're calling out for something better. Is there no medicine for the sickness that we have of our soul?" And these people who were in slavery and who were struggling with the injustice of the world and who were struggling with being treated poorly and who would call out for the same thing. When is God going to show up and restore us and do something in the world? They wrote this song called "The Balm." There's a balm in Gilead. And these are the words. "There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. If you cannot preach like Peter and you cannot pray like Paul, you just tell the love of Jesus, how he died to save us all. And this is how God came down the mountain. And this is how God showed himself to us. He showed up in human flesh, willing to die for everybody on the planet, willing to give himself to show that God will show up and has showed up, willing to say that God is inclusively offering himself to anybody who will take it, showing us that there is a balm from Gilead, there is healing for the sick soul, there is forgiveness for the guilty, there is restoration for those who need it, there is strength for the weak, and this God would come down the mountain to the people that you might least expect him to show up for. And when they say, "Oh, if we could just get some crumbs from the table," he says, "Good answer, because that's what this kingdom is all about. It will be an offering for the entire world." And when the world looks and says, "Is there no answer? Is there no balm? Is there no medicine? Is there no physician?" You might not be able to pray like you think you ought to or preach like you ought to, but let's tell people of Jesus who came and died for the world. Heavenly Father, thank you that you've showed us what you're like. Thank you that you've made yourself available to us. Thank you, God, for those moments in our lives where we feel like the woman who's the wrong everything and we're just begging for scraps from the table. We thank you that the answer is that absolutely we'll get those crumbs and the bread of life and we can eat to our satisfaction. God, I want to lift up anybody who's come today and they feel like they're the wrong something. They have the wrong past. They have the wrong lifestyle. They have the wrong inner workings for some reason. God, would you speak to them powerfully by your Spirit in these moments, and they may they know that you've come for them. You've come to them. And God, for those of us who have accepted your love and your mercy, would you empower us to pour that out of our lives into this world, that all may know the powerful message that comes first to the Jew, but then to everybody else. To this entire world, the message of love and grace, forgiveness and restoration, the message that you have drawn near to us in your love. Amen.